Welcome to The Lust Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and today I'll be talking with former Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo, who is a congressman out of Miami. He has been a member of the Branch team. He used to host a Spanish language podcast with us, and he's going to come on and talk about the immigration debate, Biden versus Trump. He's going to talk about gun control, which was something he was very much involved in when he was in Congress. He'll talk about bipartisanship and just leading in politics in 2024. But before we get there, I have a few housekeeping items. I am back. I was in India, and then I was in New York for a half a day, and then I went to Arizona to give a talk, then I went to LA to record over at the Crooked offices for that India pod. Then I went to DC to do this debate at the American Enterprise Institute that we put out last Thursday. But now I'm back, and there are a couple of interesting things that have happened over the course of the past week that are relevant to this podcast. One was, we had this episode with Dhruv Kolar, Dr. Kolar from The New Yorker, where we talked about these scans, like these commercial scans. And we were talking about Prenovo, which was the scan that he and I did, which is an MRI scan. And we're talking about, like, what, you know, should we have these scans available or not? And we were both sharing our personal experiences. Well, I had a big personal experience about these last week. My dad went in for a scan a couple weeks ago or 2 weeks ago of his heart, a commercial heart scan, which is not obviously part of the normal healthcare experience. And they found a major blockage in the so-called like widowmaker's artery, which is basically a killer. So they rushed him in for open heart surgery last week, which was successful, basically saved his life. So we're going to have Dr. Kolar back on very soon in one of the next few episodes to kind of review that and just talk about some other items. But it's so interesting that stuff that we talk about in this podcast is like literally life or death. And I'm glad my dad's in recovery. And I'll have a lot more to say about that, but it's just really fascinating. You know, we're kind of talking about this from a theoretical perspective, you know, making it real for me and Dhruv, who had our own examples of the scans, but then obviously this big moment with my dad. There's another experience I've had, which is, you know, I've been really honest lately on this pod, and most of you heard this, but at the end of last year, Ricky and I did a pod where we talked about how Ricky was going to be on way less because I was traveling to India and she was taking on more course load and is gearing up for a very big project in her world, which I'm sure we'll have her on to talk about in the coming months. And so in some ways, I've been trying out a couple of different pieces of this podcast about how to share my own opinions, but also having on other guests, including Republicans like today with Carlos. It's funny, I get these criticisms, you know, sometimes, including last week, that I'm too right-wing, you know, whether it's I'm advocating for ESAs or I'm criticizing Tish James's investigation, or I'm saying Biden's too old. So I get criticism from people on the left who say I'm both sidesing and all this kind of stuff. And then I get criticisms from people on the right who say that I'm just like another left-wing stooge or whatever. And I find that fascinating. And I don't necessarily say it's a mark of me doing anything right or necessarily wrong. I try to treat each criticism independent. And the one I want to address on the top end here was about our Tuesday episode with Michael Scheer. Michael Scheer and I had an exchange that I had two or three messages that said, hey, number one, Scheer was biased and he was saying this was an alleged murder of Lake and Riley, which is the Georgia College student who was killed recently by what Scheer said was, I think, was allegedly murdered by an illegal immigrant or somebody who was alleged to be an illegal immigrant, but used the alleged language, right? So people said, why is he saying alleged? Because this was clearly from an illegal immigrant. And then the second criticism was that they said, I laughed at this comment. So I just want to play this clip because I don't think this is a small thing. I think this is actually indicative of how we want to talk to each other on this podcast and how we want to relate to each other and the whole spirit in which we go about these discussions on this podcast. So let's play this clip.
When Trump goes down to the border on Thursday, I guess, we already know that he's going to make a big, big deal about a murder in Georgia that was allegedly perpetrated by somebody who was a migrant or somebody who was undocumented in the United States. And so you can sort of see the two sides of the kind of campaigning, right? You can imagine Trump like railing about the dangers of migrants killing little old ladies in Georgia and, right, you know, Biden talking about, you know, kind of effective policy executive orders and sort of blaming Congress for not, you know, passing legislation, which, you know, I think there's a lot of people legitimately who could look at those two things and say, gee, that Biden sounds a lot more responsible. But that's not often how American politics works. I kind of wonder.
All right. So there are a couple of things to unpack here. Number one is the alleged comment. Now, I didn't catch it in the moment, but we say allege all the time, and it's just kind of a thing that, you know, people do when they're talking about any incident that hasn't gone through trial. Even the Wall Street Journal talking about this used the word allege. So this is them from February 27th as all this was going down. It said, quote, a Venezuelan migrant's alleged killing of a Georgia college student has fueled efforts to tighten laws in the state. It's kind of standard practice. And then today, even on Fox News's website, they say Trump-Biden response to alleged illegal immigrant murder of college student Lakin Riley. Now, there's no question what Fox News thinks about this murder. They don't think it was alleged. They think it was real. And there's tons of evidence to support that. But I think this is about more than the comment Scheer made. I think, number one, he's from the New York Times, so people have a certain feeling about that. And I think, number two, people, I think, are understandably very animated about the illegal immigration debate, which is why we have done 10-plus episodes on it, because we think it's serious. We've been doing these episodes for years, and we think it's real, which is also why I think Congress should pass this damn bill to help shore up our border and invest more in all the kinds of things that we've been talking about here, because I think it's very serious. Number two is this comment, this sort of suggestion that I was laughing at the death of a child. This is the most important one, because I think this is indicative of where we are in our politics. The comments I got were from some people, I think, who have been listening to this podcast for a long time. You know, I was a former school principal. You probably have a sense of who I am and what I care about. I think it's a little wild to think that after knowing me for this long, you think I would think a murder of a child is funny. I really do think we need to relate to each other at a different level. For those of you who had that impression, the Coddling of the American Mind, the sort of precursor to Ricky's book, talks about this sort of assume the worst culture that we have. We want to read everything in the worst possible light. What's the most likely explanation of what you just heard? Is it that I think the murder of a child is funny, or that the thing that Scheer said at the end, which is what I was laughing at, which is that nobody's going to care about Biden's policy, that's not how our politics works. The more obvious explanation is that I was laughing at that comment, not at the murder of a child. So the point here is, look, people, we've got to assume the best in each other, right? Like, this podcast audience includes people who voted for Trump and plan to vote for him again. People who voted for Biden, plan to vote for him again. People don't plan to vote at all. The only way that we relate to each other is that we assume the best and we have these conversations in good faith. And that's why I think they just need to pass this damn legislation to shore up the border. This is actually Republican legislation, as we've talked about before. The reporting is very clear that Trump is pushing members of Congress to block this, not because it's bad policy, but because it's bad politics for him. And we're going to call that out, just like we're going to say Biden is too old to run for president, or that Tish James is politically motivated. And it doesn't mean that it's the truth. It just means that it's the truth as I see it, and hopefully as our guests see it, that we have on here. And yes, we'll have spirited debates, we'll have spirited discussions. But on this issue, the politics matter. The politics are what are standing in our way. And so occasionally when we talk about issues like immigration, the politics are going to be the central focus of our conversation. And, you know, one last piece here is, like, we're going to talk about serious subjects and it's going to be lighthearted sometimes, just because we podcast multiple times a week. And sometimes when you're relating to people, you know, have a bit of gallows humor. A good example is when I talked to Isaac about Gaza all these times, we would kind of laugh at how flabbergasted we were at BB's strategy or lack thereof, or about how, you know, I talked to Todd Rose about it, how members of the left don't know which river or which sea they're talking about when they're talking about from the river to sea. We're going to laugh about that. Now, of course, we don't think people dying or war is funny. But we're having a conversation about it. And sometimes you can only laugh at tragic events. But again, I didn't laugh at the murder of a child. I think that's clear from listening to that audio. But even if it was a closer call, let's just assume the best in each other, right? I don't think you'd be listening to this podcast if you thought I thought child murder was funny. Now, before we get to Carlos, I want to talk about this just avalanche of legal developments that have happened in Trump world. We've had at least five by my count. So I'm going to go through these. You know, people tell me I talk too fast sometimes when I'm in these debates, like at the American Enterprise Institute. I may talk a little too fast on this one, but I'm probably going to use the cadence I use in these Israel podcasts, because I do want to get to Carlos. But let's go through these. The biggest thing to happen just happened today, which is the Supreme Court took only 25 days after oral argument to rule in the Trump ballot access case. This was about Trump being removed from the Colorado ballot. Supreme Court took just 25 days to rule there. This is the shortest turnaround in a merits case since 2016. And they rejected the states. They said that the states lack authority to reject presidential candidates on the grounds that they engaged in rebellion or insurrection against the U.S. We'll put in the show notes the discussion I had with Isaac on this, where we both agreed that this is where the court was going. We had a different spin on the substance of it. I felt like the law was behind the states, but it was impractical for the states to have this authority. And we both agreed that the court would smack them down. This was an unsigned opinion, which effectively puts an end to all the ballot challenges against Trump. And the way they ruled here was really interesting. The court said, quote, Congress makes Congress rather than the states responsible for enforcing Section 3 against federal office holders and candidates. This was referring to the 14th Amendment. The court was more specific than I think people were expecting. They said that Congress has to pass legislation to implement how the enforcement works. Isaac and I had this debate around whether it was self-enforcing or not, and I quoted Will Bode from the University of Chicago on that. The court is saying that not only do the states not have authority, but the authority really has to come from an act of Congress, a piece of legislation. So they're basically even taking it out of their own hands to say that this authority exists, meaning taking it out of the court's hands, and also taking it out of Congress's hands when they're certifying election results. Now, what's fascinating, though, is that although this was a per curiam decision, it was all nine justices who signed on in an unsigned opinion, four justices in two separate opinions said that the majority had gone too far. So they said, all right, although we agree that states don't have authority, we think they were too specific in saying that it's only Congress who has the authority. And so Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, the liberal justices, all signed on to an opinion. They didn't necessarily say, specify how Congress had more authority or the courts or whoever has more authority, but I think they felt like the court was too specific in saying that only congressional legislation could remove somebody. Barrett essentially agreed with them, but it was a little bit about tone. So that was fascinating. So that was one piece. Another piece is that on Wednesday afternoon of last week, the court issued a one-pager in which they granted cert to review the D.C. Circuit's ruling that former President Trump is not immune from the January 6th criminal prosecution. The court expedited the briefing and set arguments for the week of April 22nd. And so by the end of this term, they're going to resolve whether Trump can stand trial for his role in January 6th. The procedure here is really fascinating. So although Trump had asked for a stay while he appealed the DC court decision, the court treated the stay application as if it were an appeal itself. If you don't understand what I said, you don't have to understand it. What it essentially means is that if they hadn't treated the stay application as an appeal, this case wouldn't have been heard until October. But through some trickery or some crafty interpretation of the procedure, this court will be hearing this on an expedited basis. And I think this is fascinating because a lot of people, I don't blame people for not wanting to give this court the benefit of the doubt. Because as I've said many times in this podcast, this is a political institution. By the way that we, you know, select these things, the way that we approve them, the way that the nominees talk in front of hearings, what they say, what they don't say, even going back to law school with the ACS and the Federal Society and just how we vet people politically for these jobs. It is a political institution. So I don't begrudge people for being skeptical of the court. But I mention this procedure because the people who say that this court was doing Trump a solid, maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, I can't get in the court's head. They basically are saying that they should have just rejected the appeal, which would have let the DC case go on. If this court, though, was totally on Trump's side here and trying to help him through the procedure, they would have waited until October to decide this case. But they didn't. They expedited it for April, and this would put it in a pretty fast track. Now, fast enough to get a trial if they reject the immunity claim? I have no idea. The other interesting piece here is that the question presented, because the court has to then say in their brief, okay, this is the question that's presented. The question presented was, quote, whether and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? People view this as a bit of a narrow tailoring because it's saying acts alleged to involve his official acts. Conduct alleged to involve his official acts. So it doesn't include things that he would have done that wouldn't have been within the official purview. And there's some speculation that even if the court upholds Trump's ability to his immunity for official acts. That doesn't count things that are non-official, like electioneering activities, etc. It's unclear here, actually, whether the court has bound itself, because they can go beyond the question presented. They don't have to really stick to the question presented. So unclear there what's going on. But I find those two things really interesting. There were a couple of other interesting parts of the court's sort of one-pager. One is that there was this question of whether the president is an officer of the United States or not. All right, so that is the immunity case. There is more, though. There's at least four more developments here. In Florida, on Friday, Trump attorneys told Judge Aileen Cannon that his Mar-a-Lago classified documents case should wait until after the 2024 election. And that hearing took place at roughly the same time as a hearing in Georgia, where attorneys for Trump and his co-defendants made their final arguments to Judge Scott McAfee in a bid to disqualify Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis in the Georgia racketeering case. And she was, this has been going on for a while over her relationship with the special prosecutor in that case. There, you know, there's an argument about whether she should be disqualified from that case. Neither Aileen Cannon in Florida or McAfee in Georgia made any rulings Friday, but we could see rulings pretty soon on both of those. I would say the Georgia one probably more imminently. Friday's hearings in Georgia marked the final arguments in that case. And this followed several weeks of testimony that included Wade, the special prosecutor, and Willis, who both took the stand. There's some interesting quotes from Judge McAfee in his questioning where he seems to, if I were guessing, he'd take some middle ground where he might sanction Willis, but not remove her. That's my read on it, although I wouldn't say I'm super confident there. Just like with the Bragg case and Tish James, I just wonder why Willis just doesn't recuse herself in this case. Like, complicated questions about when prosecutors should recuse themselves, but why not just recuse yourself, given how high profile this is? Now, on the Florida documents case, Special Counsel Jack Smith has asked for a July date, while Trump attorneys asked for filings to begin in August. Although they also are simultaneously arguing that the case should be punted past November, which is something that Jack Smith's team pointed out, the contradiction between those two things. Hard to say what's going to happen there. All of this is happening as Trump's former CFO, Alan Weisselberg, admitted on Monday to testifying falsely to a New York Attorney General Tish James about his knowledge of the size of Donald Trump's apartment triplex and the value of that apartment and how it was inflated. He also admitted to lying again in 2023 and on the stand last October. Last month, the judge overseeing the Attorney General's case found Weisselberg liable for fraud and ordered him to pay $1 million plus interest, and he'll be sentenced in April. That seems notable. Now, this all gets me to the most important case left here, which is, I think, the weakest of all the cases. On March 25th, jury selection begins for the Stormy Daniels hush money case here in New York City in Manhattan. And this is the Alvin Bragg case. I've written about this. We could put it in the show notes. I have said that he should recuse himself and Tish James should recuse themselves because of their statements made on the campaign trail. I think that Alvin, who I know very well, I was a strategist on his campaign, the first person to endorse him when he ran for DA. I've been publicly critical of him on this, even though he and I are good friends. I think he should have recused himself, and I think he got bullied into this case. These charges are they're for business records fraud related to Trump's alleged misclassification of reimbursement payments to Michael Cohen, who's his former lawyer and fixer. Cohen paid Stormy Daniels, who's a adult film actress, he paid her $130,000 during the 2016 presidential campaign to keep her quiet about an alleged sexual encounter with Trump years earlier. And you may say, why no alleged with Cohen paying? Because Cohen has admitted that he paid and was convicted of that. Trump faces 34 counts of falsifying business records. These are Class E felonies under New York law that do not automatically carry jail time. So it'll be interesting that if he does get convicted by a Manhattan jury, not hard to do in a very blue Manhattan, will it carry jail time or not? We don't know. I suspect it would based on the politics of it and the amount of charges. So this is going to be an interesting case, and it's going to be a fascinating case in the courtroom because you have the star witness is Cohen, who is, you know, the Trump defense is going to try to say, well, you've lied before. Why aren't you, why should the jury believe you now? Why aren't you lying now? Like, you got a plea deal. know, you got a better deal because you cooperated with authorities, probably promised them you'd testify against Trump. You've seen enough TV to know how that goes. And if you read the legal commentary on this, most legal observers think that this is a bit of a stretch under the law, but that the facts are pretty much beyond dispute is how people kind of treat this. But it is a Manhattan jury. It is a case in Manhattan, and this is not subject to the pardon authority because it's a state case. So I think this is what stands after all this legal stuff right now. You've got Jack Smith's DC case, which is in limbo until the Supreme Court rules. You've got the documents case, which I think is by far the strongest against Trump, which is with a judge in Aileen Cannon, which I have lots of questions about that, and that could very well be delayed. You've got Georgia, which is under the cloud of this allegations against Fani Willis. And you've got this case in New York, and this is the one that's going to be heard first, without a doubt, jury selection later this month. This is where we stand right now. It is so much activity. I just can't even imagine what these next 6 months are going to be like if some of these other cases loosen up. The presidential campaign will be about these legal cases. So we will continue to report on them. But as it stands right now, all eyes are on Manhattan. Well, now, with that, let me welcome my friend Carlos Curbelo. He was a congressman from Florida's 26th Congressional District from 2015 to 2019. He used to host a podcast with us, as I mentioned. He now runs Vocero, a public affairs communications and advocacy firm, and he routinely shows up on TV and elsewhere, commentating on the issues of the day. And I am glad to have him here with us. All right, Carlos, let's start with the issue of the day, which has really been the issue of the past few years, something you and I have talked about before when we've had you on this podcast long ago, which is immigration. But let's start with the politics of it, because the politics are what are standing in the way of any sensible solution here. And the politics are fascinating. Just 2 days ago, the New York Times put out a poll that showed that Biden continues to lose support amongst Latino or Hispanic voters, and Trump is actually picking up speed. This, I'll quote from the article about this. It says, the poll shows Mr. Trump edging out Mr. Biden among Hispanic voters, with 46% supporting the former president and 40% favoring Mr. Biden, because Latino voters make up just 50% of the electorate. The poll sample size of the group is not large enough to assess these differences reliably. You have a window into this in South Florida, which is obviously a particular collection of Hispanics down there, but you comment on these issues. You've been thinking about these for a long time. Does this poll surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me, Ravi. It's a continuation of a trend that we've been seeing for quite some time, and that's been particularly accentuated here in South Florida and South Texas. That's where Hispanics have most shifted towards Republicans in recent years. But the truth is, this is a phenomenon all over the country. And I think there are a few explanations for it. It's complex. It's not something that you can easily explain. But certainly, President Biden is not popular generally, and Hispanics are not an exception. They don't approve of his handling of the economy. They don't approve of his handling of the immigration issue. Democrats for a long time have assumed that the Hispanic community is okay with irregular immigration, illegal immigration, whatever people prefer to call it. The truth is, there are a lot of Hispanics who see what's happened at the Southwest border and they're alarmed by it. They don't like it. Some of them might have come to the country legally and resent the fact that people are coming to the country and kind of jumping the line. Others, sure, there might be some people who have double standards out there for themselves versus people coming now. But the bottom line is that Democrats are losing ground with Hispanics. I've been saying for years that Democrats have to change the way they approach the community. I think Democrats have been comfortable with addressing minority groups with a victimhood narrative, which has worked for their base for some time. But I think some of these victimhood narratives sound better to wealthy white liberals than to members of minority groups who, sure, although they might be disadvantaged in some way, they want to be recognized as fully American and fully capable of succeeding and growing and thriving in this country. So some cultural issues there, some policy issues, but whatever the case, Democrats are losing ground with Hispanic voters.
Yeah, I think about my dad, who is an immigrant from India, and he's been a Republican his whole life, and or since he's been in the U.S. And that point you made about the victimhood, I think, is so important, because he escaped extreme poverty in India, and he came here and did not like being told that he should be made to be feel the victim. He was like, I am like super excited to be here. And this is where I go Thomas Friedman on this, which is like, I was in Arizona last week and I had this Burundian Uber driver. This is like such a Thomas Friedman moment. And this guy, I don't know if he's Republican or Democrat, but what I found interesting about him is he was saying to me in the car, he's like, all these people telling me all these negative things about America. He's like, this is the greatest place on earth. My dad was killed in a genocide. I got here and I've now been able to get financing for this car. I've been able to move my family here. He'd won the immigration lottery. So he's like a very select few, like very lucky guy. And he knows
that. So listen, that is a great point. And I try to explain this to some of my liberal friends. If you're a Hispanic immigrant, you probably feel like you won the lottery. Right? Like people tell you, oh, this country's so unfair. It's so racist. The system is designed to keep people of color down. And these people look at you like, are you kidding me? I was having trouble finding something to eat. And now I can work. I can maybe rent an apartment. Maybe I have a car. If I don't, there's good public transportation or decent public transportation. So, you know, I guess we're a little spoiled as a country. And look, I don't dismiss a lot of the structural issues and challenges that are built into our economy. There are legacies in this country based on, you know, the sins of the past, slavery, and then segregation. But we've come a long way, and it's okay to celebrate that. And it's important to understand why what is insufficient for some of us who maybe have been here for a few generations or who happen to be privileged is more than enough for people coming from very difficult situations and unstable parts of the world.
Yeah, it's fascinating because, you know, my dad is a good example. Like, he's a MAGA Republican. He's not just a Republican. It's not that he doesn't think racism exists for him, right? Like, he would often complain about at home the treatment he felt from other doctors. And I would, you know, when we go to restaurants and stuff, people would clearly treat him a certain way because of his thick Indian accent and the way he dressed and everything. But I think the difference in the way he looked at it was how much he obsessed over it or not. Like, he would just be like, it is something that is not great, but it is an obstacle I just need to overcome, just like the poverty I had to overcome getting out of India and all that. And in his estimation, he was like, look, I'm lucky to even be here to fight these things, like, and overcome them. And I think, like, this is where the Democrats, it's like their suite of solutions seems to be so limited. And you and I have talked about this before. It's like, it's not only that the Democrats have created a monolith in terms of what they think all Hispanics think about immigration, but they also think that all that Hispanics think about is immigration too. Like, that they're not business owners, that they're not parents, and they don't speak to them as individuals. They speak to them as this monolith that has one opinion and is a single issue voting base. And you know, you talk about South Florida. When I went to Pennsylvania during the midterms, this is what I was hearing. You know, I was hearing from people who were like, look, like, I'm a business owner first. You know, I'm here and I want lower taxes. I want, you know, more sensible regulation.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting what's happened, Robbie. This just came to mind, but, you know, Democrats' identity politics strategies are starting to fail. Republicans weren't very good at identity politics in the past, but Donald Trump has certainly perfected that. And while Democrats are struggling to connect with people of color with these identity politics themes, Donald Trump is doing a great job of convincing white people that they're actually an oppressed minority in this country.
Right.
And yes. Identity politics is now working for, I don't know whether to call it conservatives, but certainly for Republicans in this country. So it's just we're living at a time of political transition. So there's some realignment happening, like the one that happened in the 60s and 70s with the South having been Democratic and becoming Republican.
Yeah, there's not a lot of places to go for people like me who are sort of Obama Democrats who, you know, I know that there's a lot of revisionism, but my read on Obama was that he, especially early on, rejected identity politics. His whole campaign was, we're not a Black America, we're not a white America. there's no place for us anymore. And certainly, as we'll get to, there's no place for your brand of conservatism either. And that's a good transition to talk about the policy issues here. So both Trump and Biden went to the border to give dueling speeches last week. This comes in the context of failed legislation on the Hill. I suspect, and you and I have never spoken about this, I suspect you would have voted for that legislation on the Hill, but maybe I'm wrong.
100%. I actually filed a discharge petition in 2018 for a bill that closed a lot of the immigration loopholes that this bill would have closed, that funded border security. And back then, about half Republicans voted against it, and every Democrat voted against it. So there's always an excuse to hold on to the politics of immigration while sacrificing the good policies for immigration. And it's shameful. It's terrible. I think Republicans now do carry a part of the burden for the failure at the Southwest border these past 3+ years. That doesn't dismiss any blame that the Biden administration has to carry. They have to own it. They certainly sent messages and made tweaks to policies that, were exploited by coyotes and by the many criminal organizations who profit off of trafficking human beings. The people coming are victims. I don't blame them for trying to come to this country. Our families wanted to come to this country and did. We can have a debate about how they did it, but I don't blame anyone for coming, wanting to come to this country. But the people who make policy in this country do have to respond for their actions. And Republicans now have to respond for intentionally killing a deal that would have tied the hands of future administrations. So if a very liberal administration had been elected, gets elected in the future, this law would have limited the executive's authority to essentially open up the South, any border. And then, of course, President Biden, I don't have to say it. It's pretty clear from polling that he's carrying the burden of the failed border policies of the last few years. But I do think Republicans have given Democrats a little bit of an out here by being petty and by listening to Donald Trump, who is nakedly saying, don't pass this, because even though it's good policy, it would make it harder for me to win, which, by the way, I don't think is even true from a political strategy standpoint. If I was campaigning out there as a Republican, I'd say, look, we bailed them out at the end, and it's still been a disaster.
Yeah, or you could say the only reason why he did this is because of our pressure.
Yeah, we forced him to do it. It makes no sense.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I don't have any faith that the Biden team is going to be able to capitalize on this, but one, could expect a vigorous campaign to really lay this at the feet of the Republicans and say, this is a symbol of more than immigration. It's a symbol of dysfunction. Now, that may still happen, right?
Right.
Like, what was interesting about the midterms is, I talked about being in Pennsylvania. Democrats still won what they needed to win in Pennsylvania in the midterms, despite the dynamics there, in part because the Republicans keep handing the Democrats crazy. And I think this kind of crazy, the average person sitting at home, including members of our audience who are fairly, I would say, restrictionist when it comes to the border, they look at this and say, there's no way to explain this. There's no way to explain the obstructionism. And it's not like Ukraine, where I think the majority of both Americans and our audience are on board with supporting Ukraine, as am I. But there's a lot more daylight there than on this immigration piece, where I think most people look at it and say, Josh Hawley could get up and give a speech about why the U.S. shouldn't be involved in foreign countries and should be more isolationist and all. And it could be a coherent theory. Mm-hmm. No Republican could credibly get up and give a speech as to why they would oppose that border bill.
No, there's only one explanation, because we chose politics over good policy. And again, even then, I think it made no sense, because if you're astute, if you're reasonably good at persuading people, you can make the case that, you did pass that bill because you forced Biden to the table because they had failed so miserably that it was their only option, right? So I don't get it. It's very disappointing. My heart breaks for Senator Lankford, Senator Sinema, who's at the center of every deal and just fought tirelessly for this deal. And of course, Senator Murphy, too, who made some difficult concessions because the Democratic base isn't on board with closing all the immigration loopholes. The Democratic base Treasurer's asylum policy. And that was going to be significantly curtailed, rightfully so, because our asylum policies are too broad right now. Essentially, anyone who wants to come to this country for economic opportunity can somehow find a way to qualify under our asylum laws. And that's just, you know, that's not the way the law was designed.
Well, speaking of trying to pass legislation and failing, back in 2017, you teamed up with Seth Moulton to introduce legislation to ban bumper stocks. So this would be news to our audience because they'd be like, oh, wait, you're a Republican. But 2017 was the year of a horrific attack. In October 2017, a man named Stephen Paddock took aim at thousands of concert goers, and he fired more than 1,000 rounds of ammunition over 11 minutes. It was the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history at the time. I don't know if it still is. And this led to, you know, as these things tend to do, a temporary uptick in willingness to entertain sensible restrictions. And what happened after that? And maybe take a step back and talk about what these bumper stocks are, because they're now in front of the Supreme Court.
I'll give you the inside story, because this was a horrible tragedy. It as a policymaker, I want people to understand that when these things happen, you feel an extra heavy weight on your shoulders, because you wonder if there's anything you can do to prevent this kind of tragedy from happening again in the future. And in this case, a lot of times there isn't. And sometimes people who are for stricter gun laws get annoyed, but you know, certain massacres or gun crimes are just probably not preventable by tweaking the law or by changing the law. But this was different. So for people to understand, I'm not a gun expert. I don't own any guns, at least not for now. And but
that's
yeah,
I we'll see how the rest of the year goes.
Yeah, who knows, right? I hope I feel comfortable a year from now not owning any guns, but I don't for now. So semi-automatic weapons are legal under the law. Automatic weapons are illegal. A bump stock allows a semi-automatic weapon to perform as if it were an automatic weapon, which essentially means that you can fire a lot more rounds in a shorter period of time. And if you're trying to kill a lot of people, this is convenient for you, right? So I got together with Seth Moulton, wonderful lawmaker from Massachusetts, Democrat, and said, hey, let's just do something very simple. Let's ban bump stocks. Let's say you cannot use bump stocks because they convert legal weapons into illegal weapons, essentially. A lot of people were okay with this. We got a good number of co-sponsors right out of the gate. Speaker Ryan, Paul Ryan, said it made sense. But this is what happens on the Hill. We had a couple special interest groups, Gun Owners of America, NRA. They don't want any new legislation. They were okay with executive action, but they didn't want Congress to act. They don't want Republicans to develop any habit of voting for gun restrictions. So leadership team comes and says, hey, we promise you this is going to be taken care of by the administration. They agree with you. Everyone agrees with you. You know, this has to change, but it's going to be changed. And yeah, I said, well, who cares? If everyone agrees, let's just change the law. That way it's a permanent change, right? Kind of like the argument I made to you earlier about a liberal administration coming in and opening up the borders. What if a super right-wing administration takes over and says, well, we want to allow bump stocks again. Let's just change it. No, please trust us. We're gonna get this done, but it'll be faster. It'll be easier if the administration does it. Well, here we are, of course. They kept their word. I mean, the administration did write a new reg to ban or limit the use of bump stocks, but it was challenged.
Yeah, and just to pause on that, Carlos, because I think this is news to a lot of people, is that the Trump administration interpreted the National Firearms Act of 1934, which made it illegal to own a machine gun, and interpreted that to say that it extended to bump stocks, which I think is a reasonable interpretation, which we'll get to. The court is wrestling with this question right now. And as you feared, that measure may not last beyond this year.
Right. So this is what happens when Congress is cowardly, when Congress refuses to act. And by the way, this happens all the time. We have had the Supreme Court and other courts legislate so many new laws over the last few decades because members of Congress are too afraid to act, right? I mean, look at the vote on marriage equality last session. It passed overwhelmingly, but Congress didn't legalize gay marriage. The Supreme Court did, because Congress was too afraid to do that for years. This is another case, right? And like this one, there are countless cases where there's consensus in Congress. Most of the Congress agrees, just like most of the country agrees, but nothing happens. Why? Because of base politics. Politicians are scared of their primary voters on the left and the right. More so on the right these days than on the left, but it's a dynamic that exists in both parties, and because of special interest groups. Oh, if you do this or that, we're going to have to, you used to have an A and now you're going to have a B, and that's the end of the world.
Let me just underline the point about the differences between base politics, because I want to get back to that because I think it's such an important point. But before we get there, let me just explain a little bit about the posture of this. So last Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard a challenge to the very executive action that you're talking about. And what's interesting about it, with the bump stock executive action, which was a result of you pushing for legislation, right? What's interesting about this challenge is it's not under the Second Amendment. It's a challenge, it's an administrative challenge, as a lot of challenges have been in this court, because this is a court that through the Chevron deference challenges and things like that, that we've talked about a lot in this podcast, things like the major questions doctrine, which longtime listeners will know about. This is like a kind of backdoor challenge. It's saying that the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau, overstepped its authority in interpreting the National Firearms Act of 1934 as including bump stocks within the machine gun category. And the oral arguments in this case are very interesting. So, you know, Thomas is asking questions that you wouldn't expect him to, or he sounds like he thinks this isn't a reasonable interpretation. We'll see if he votes that way. The justices are just confused as to what a bump stock is. And whether there were so many questions about, well, do you have to pull the trigger multiple times and all this kind of stuff? And I actually, as a, I'm a pretty avid court watcher. I don't know where they're going to come down on this. I think in particular, because it's not Second Amendment, which if people are confused as to why it's not Second Amendment, it's because a ban on machine guns under current jurisprudence is acceptable under the Second Amendment. It's like, you have to ask yourself, the court needs to have a way to ban nuclear weapons, right? Like they have to, because those are arms too. So the government needs to be able to say, well, okay, right to bear arms has reasonable limitations. And so the machine guns has to be in that, or shoulder fire missiles, right? Like most reasonable people will say that is not an acceptable personal use of a firearm. Where we draw that line is in different place, which is why me, as somebody who's fairly restrictionist on this as a New Yorker, has fun with my friends on the right about this, because they can, where we draw the line is nowhere in the Constitution. It has all to do with culture and history of the United States and all that. But that's why it's not Second Amendment. It's a long way of saying that. But I actually don't know where this is going to go. I don't know if you have an opinion about where this court is going to land on this.
I think it's probably going to be a very close vote. But I think the broader point is that we shouldn't be here. We shouldn't be here. I mean, the purpose of Congress is to make laws, to improve laws, sometimes to cancel laws, to get rid of laws. That is why Congress exists. But Congress is paralyzed by, oh, you want to maybe get into it, base politics, the base voters, like the 10%, 15, maybe max 20% of each party, people who show up to vote in primaries, and by special interest groups. As politicians, everyone wants to get an A. It's like we want straight A's. Well, if you do the right thing, you might get a B for 1 year, and then you can.
What did you get that year, by the way, for pushing that legislation?
I gotta look. I imagine, right? A C. Yeah, which is
you should hang that up.
Passing grade.
Yeah, you should hang that up. Well, okay, let's end on the politics, right? So, you're an astute observer. It used to be that your home state was more interesting. I don't think it will be for a while again in these campaigns. But you mentioned this sort of base politics. I find it interesting. You know, I talked to David Frum the other day about this, but I've been talking to people all year about this. Democrats have a more diverse coalition in the sense of both ideologically and racially, although, as we mentioned, Republicans' base is becoming more diverse in some ways. But at least for the time being, Democrats, I think, the base politics are way more unwieldy because of that diversity of, you know, I think it's and I also think like the sort of nature of Democrats are way less fall in line than Republicans. And so I think like the road for Biden to win this election, even if you weren't looking at the polls, which are pretty, you know, damning to him right now, but just the road to holding this coalition together in a world where Gaza is happening, in the world where he's doing things like pushing immigration, in the world where there are, you know, concerns about his age, especially among your younger voters. That road, I feel like, is much more narrow than for Trump, who seems to have a more homogenous base ideologically and racially. That's my theory, but I don't know how if I'm fully confident in that, but that's my current belief.
I think I agree with you. This is what I'll tell you. There is no Biden coalition. There is potentially an anti-Trump coalition. The anti-Trump coalition has showed up in three consecutive general elections. In 18, they showed up to remove centrist Republicans, punishing them for being too aligned with Trump. I was one of those. In 2020, they showed up to vote against Trump because he was too chaotic, too wild, too many scandals, too unstable. And they took the Senate away from Republicans that year as well, in Georgia, of all places, right? Republicans lost the two Senate seats. And in 22, Republicans were supposed to sweep. It was going to be an historic turnout for Republicans. They were going to have this massive House majority, you know, maybe win back the Senate. None of that happened, okay? They barely took over the House, and Trump-aligned Senate candidates lost every single swing state in which they ran. So the coalition that exists is an anti-Trump coalition. The question is whether Biden's numbers are bad enough to break up that anti-Trump coalition.
I think that's they may, the question Carlos. Here. I think they may.
And I think this is how this shakes out. If the election is about Trump, and we should not underestimate Trump's ability to make it exclusively about him, Biden can keep that anti-Trump coalition together. If this election is about Joe Biden, Trump's going to win. There's no way around it.
This is why our audience will probably get tired of me saying this. I predicted this. My prediction for this coming year was that one of the two of Biden and Trump will not be on the ballot in November, which I know is a crazy prediction.
I'm with you.
I just think this. I'm with you. The incentives are too strong. Like, I think the first, I think Frank Luntz said this the other day, the first party to offer any alternative. I mean, honestly, just pick a random stranger off the street. I think they win. And I think in part, if you're focusing on the Democrats, is where I spend all my time pretty much, is I agree with you on the anti-Trump coalition. That means that pick random governor, you know, throw Josh Shapiro
Phil Murphy
there,
wins. Right? Phil Murphy wins.
Right. Anybody.
Anyone.
Yeah.
Vanilla. Democratic vanilla. Yeah. People will take it because it'll give them the excuse, say, you know what? I really don't like Donald Trump and this person seems okay. That's the key. I'm glad to hear someone else say this because I have been saying it for a while. Half of Democrats do not want President Biden to represent them on the November ballot. Half of Democrats. I mean, how do you go ahead and do it anyway? I don't know.
It's wild. It's absolutely wild. Now, what people will say is, well, it's too late, whatever, as if like a brokered convention is curing cancer.
Give me
this
a break.
Happened before in
but like we have any precedents we respect in American politics anymore.
But also the precedence is like Lincoln was picked at a brokered convention, nominating convention. So this has happened before in some weird way. As somebody who distrusts the extremes of my party, maybe this is better. I don't know. Like, I suspect somebody I wouldn't love would come out of it, like a Gavin Newsom or somebody. But whatever. Like, I do think that these people are somebody who could coherently get up on stage and make the case. If Trump is like doing things like this immigration thing, like you just need somebody who could speak in complete sentences and speak coherently to be like, look, this is what this guy is doing and this is why it's wrong. Like that's all they need to say. But okay. Well, Carlos, anything you want to plug today? I thank you for being so generous with your time with us.
No, I just invite everyone to keep in touch on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Carlos L. Curbelo. Let me know what you think. And always a fan of the Lost Debate, so keep doing a great job.
Well, I'll come see you down in Miami soon. This is like Miami season in New York, where the weather's not quite great enough here. You're just a hop and a skip away.
All your fellow New Yorkers are here, and I can see it every time I get it's out the onto the street.
Of New York City,
gridlock. We become Manhattan this time of year, thanks to you all.
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Remember to rate, review, subscribe. Our voicemail is 321-200-0570. We'll be back on Thursday. Thank you.